content. Parental discretion is advised.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome. It's 11 p.m. Eastern Time, Wednesday, September 2nd, 2020, and thank you for joining us for the 92nd episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We'll be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro, and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. As always, thank you for that, and if you would please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Sure. So that was probably one of my favorite tunes, excuse me, particularly for Entwistle's bass playing. So that's an excerpt from the intro to Quadrophenia, The Real Me. And I thought that was pretty appropriate given the topic we're talking about tonight. Unfortunately, like so many people, when he was writing Quadrophenia, Pete Townshend confused what was then called multiple personality disorder with schizophrenia, because a lot of people think schizophrenia is multiple personalities, and it's not. And so when he wrote this rock opera, Quadrophenia, instead of having two personalities, this individual has four, of course, the four members of the band, The Who. So that's where the Quadrophenia thing comes from. And so the intro song to the whole thing is The Real Me. You know, can you see the real me? And so I thought that was, I thought that'd be great intro for tonight's part two. The saga continues.
Da, da, da. That's awesome. Yes, very good choice. As Dr. Mathis mentions, tonight's episode is entitled Dissociative Identity Disorder, Part 2, which we will discuss in a moment. So before we begin our topic discussion, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
So I thought about actually doing a list of famous people with dissociative identity disorder, but what I discovered is a lot of the news articles were actually about people who did not have DID. They either had schizophrenia or a borderline personality disorder, so I thought that was pretty interesting, which just sort of leads more credence to why we're doing this show, right, to educate people as to the appropriate stuff and to separate the wheat from the chaff. Yeah. So I thought a really good alternative, and which I almost did last time, but I decided to save it for this time, is I want to do a shout-out to a musician who passed the end of August this year, Frankie Benali. who is a very, very well-known rock drummer, who's one of the original members of the band Quiet Riot, who founded the band with Kevin DeBro back in the 70s and 80s. And as you may know, Metal Health is the first metal record to go to number one, which actually at the time knocked off Police's Synchronicity on the number one chart in the nation. And so I thought it would be kind of a nice shout out to talk about him in brief tonight. So originally, as I mentioned, he started playing with Randy Rhoads. Actually, he started out with a bunch of regular musicians, but eventually ended up with Randy Rhoads and Dana Strum, which is the bass player that moved on to other bands. And of course, most of you know Randy Rhoads moved on to Ozzy Osbourne. But he started out with Quiet Riot. We actually have a couple of records with him on it. And with Rudy Sarzo playing bass, even though Chuck Wright was the original bass player, he was replaced by Rudy Sarzo, who also left to join Ozzy. So at any rate, they started out with the band that was just called DeBro, and Kevin DeBro decided to rename it Quiet Riot. And so when the Metal Health was released, it was quite a success, I think in late 1983, and it just really skyrocketed and really propelled metal music in general to the forefront. Unfortunately, there was all this cacophony going within the band, between the members, and there were members change a lot, reportedly because of Kevin DeBro's erratic behavior. And I remember seeing interviews with him on, you know, various talk shows where he would basically denigrate the crap out of other metal bands and talk about how bad they were. And while I happen to agree with a lot of his assessments, that's not exactly the kind of thing that endears you to the hearts of people when you say that on national television. At any rate, excuse me, they continued on predominantly with DeBro and Frankie Vinali until DeBro's death because I think of a cocaine. I think he had a heart attack based on a cocaine overdose, I think, if I remember correctly. In the meantime, in between Quiet Riot Records, he was an active member of Wasp, which is another one of my favorite metal bands, which you may or may not know, that band. Really, Blackie Lawless's band, basically. And they've also gone through a boatload of personnel changes, but Benali was on a lot of their really great albums. And one of my favorite records by them, The Crimson Idol. Benali's drumming on that is just amazing. His drumming with Quiet Riot is actually pretty, it's rock solid, but it's pretty simplistic. It's not uber fancy. When you hear the stuff he's doing with Wasp, it's like, it sounds like Keith Moon. I mean, he's doing some like Keith Moon-esque stuff. It's like amazing. Personally, he when they interviewed him, he cites his main influence, not surprisingly, is John Bonham, Zeppelin's drummer Buddy Rich, which is also a Neil Peart influence. Simon Phillips, who's played with everybody, just a really great drummer, played with The Who for a while with Pete Townsend, was a longtime drummer for Toto. Dennis Chambers, who's a really great jazz drummer, and Carter Beauford's mentor, the drummer for Dave Matthews Band. Both of whom are just stellar drummers. And Dennis Chambers is in Niacin, which is the jazz trio with Billy Sheehan when he's not with Mr. Big. And if folks haven't heard that, it's really amazing. They are, that band is really awesome. So, but he's played with Hughes and Thrall, Glenn Hughes of Deep Purple and his solo stuff, and prior to Deep Purple with Trapeze, and also with Black Country Communion. And that guy's got an amazing voice. And he's played with Billy off one of Billy Thorpe's albums. He was on Hearing Aid, which was a thing that Ronnie James Dio did to raise money for I forgot what cause it was now. That was back in the middle 80s. But, I mean, he's played on a lot of different stuff and very, very well-known guy. And, excuse me, after Kevin DeBro's death, he went through a shoot ton of vocalists trying to keep Quiet Riot together. And, you know, it's just really kind of sad what happened with that. However, I wanted to put a shout-out to him because he was very well-respected in the community and has been on numerous projects. And if you ever really want to hear, in my personal opinion, if you want to hear him at his best, listen to the work with... I mean, he's good with Quiet Riot, but he's very, very constrained. If you want to hear him, like, go crazy, listen to him at the Wasp stuff. It's unbelievable. It doesn't even sound like the same drummer. I was hearing that stuff, and I'm like, holy moly, this guy's like a Keith Moon freak. And I was looking at the credits going, Frankie Vinali? I was like, what? yeah. So I want to do a shout-out because he passed, I think, the 20th of August. And just wanted to say, you know, it's a really... It was sad for me because he's like one of the last remaining folks that was on the Metal Health record, which was, you know, groundbreaking for metal music and really revitalized it back in the 80s. And been kind of going stronger since. So there you have it.
Awesome. That's a great story. Thank you for sharing that. Very good.
Sure.
So, pretty cool stuff. Again, we will take calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening until around midnight. Please feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. All right, Dissociative Identity Disorder, Part 2. Dun, dun, dun. Tonight
the
in the second half.
Continues.
Yes, it does. Yeah. It definitely does. Tonight is the second half of our first episode specifically dedicated to dissociative identity disorder by request of one of our followers. Dissociative identity disorder is more commonly known by its outdated names, multiple personality disorder or split personalities. Most people have heard of those. DID is not as well known yet. We're still working on it. This is a condition that is far more common than most people realize. When one realizes suspected DID causes are thought to be rooted in childhood trauma and abuse, and they're still working on proving this and how it works all together, and that it was often dismissed or derisively painted as a faked condition until the last few decades, one can certainly see the unfortunate potential for overlooking, underestimating, or misdiagnosing sufferers. Many of us only know about this pathology through movies and media, so we will also spend a little bit of time tonight addressing matters of misinformation. So last time when we talked about this, we talked about the history of dissociative identity disorder. And tonight we will discuss, well, we also started to talk about our current understanding of it, and we got as far as diagnosis. We talked about naming and the descriptions, definitions, and stuff like that. And then we stopped at diagnosis. That's what we'll pick up tonight, followed by myths and misconceptions about dissociative identity disorder, and suggestions for coping and mitigating symptoms. And before we get started, I'm going to check in with Dr. Mathis and see if there's anything else that you would like to say before we get going here.
Nope, I'm good. Thanks.
All righty. Diving right in. Okay, so we're going to skip the history since we did that. And so we did naming last time with our current understanding, naming, definitions, and symptoms. And now we are at diagnosis. And we left off last time with Dr. Mathis talking about, I'm going to read this question again. We don't have to get into it again, but I want to give you guys a placeholder for where we were. We were talking about what are some of the diagnostic tools for determining or differentiating whether common symptoms like the ones I talked about earlier in the show last time, are pointing to DID specifically. What is the proverbial tipping point of symptoms? Dr. Mathis, do you have anything else that you want to get into with that, or shall we dive right into the rest of diagnosis conversation?
No, let's go right into it, because I think we covered it last time pretty well.
I think we did too. All right. So the next thing I want to read you guys, the source is clevelandclinic.org. I quote them several times during the show. How is dissociative identity disorder diagnosed? And they said, if symptoms are present, an evaluation will be done with a complete medical history and physical examination. Although no laboratory test can diagnose dissociative disorders medically, various diagnostic tests such as blood tests or imaging like x-rays, CAT scans, or MRIs may be used to rule out physical illness or medication side effects. Pardon me a moment. I clear my throat. Okay. If no physical illness or explanation is found, the person might be referred to a mental health professional such as a psychiatrist, psychologist, or psychiatric social worker who is specially trained to diagnose and treat mental illnesses. They will perform a clinical interview to get a full picture of the person's past experiences and current functioning. Some psychiatrists and psychologists may employ specialized tests. For example, the Dissociative Experiences Scale, DES, or a standard interview such as a structured clinical interview for dissociation, SCID-D. The next thing I want to read you guys is from DIDresearch.org, and it's about DID versus OSDD. It's a little crunchy and technical here, but it's a good distinction to know. Okay, OSDD. Other specified dissociative disorder is a dissociative disorder that serves as a catch-all category for symptom clusters that do not fit neatly within another dissociative disorder diagnosis. A lot of D's going on tonight. This diagnosis was known as dissociative disorder not otherwise specified, DDNOS, before the DSM-5. Both OSDD and DDNOS contained examples of specific possible symptom clusters within the diagnosis. These examples were, and often still are, used as subtypes of this disorder. It's used for individuals who have similar symptoms to those of DID, but who do not meet the full diagnostic criteria for DID, which we talked about last episode. Most commonly, this describes individuals who have dissociative parts that are not sufficiently differentiated to qualify as alters, sometimes known as OSDD1A, or individuals who do not have amnesia between alters, sometimes known as OSDD1B. Some individuals with OSDD1 lack both amnesia and highly distinct parts, and other individuals with OSDD1 have highly distinct parts, but rarely or never switch between them. These latter cases are also sometimes described as OSDD1B. OSDD1A is unique but difficult to diagnose because there's no clear boundary that determines if a part is associated with sufficient, quote, discontinuities. Wow, that's a mouthful.
Discontinuities.
In sense of self and agency, end quote, to warrant a diagnosis of DID. So,
yeah, I want to point out that.
Yeah.
I want to go say that every disorder in the DSM has a not what used to be called not otherwise specified category, which is now called other specified or other unspecified. Fill in the blank: major depression disorder, anxiety, whatever. So if it sort of looks like, walks like, talks like the disorder, but it doesn't quite meet the criteria, it gets what I call the garbage can category. And the only difference between specified and not specified is for some reason on the not specifieds, the clinician refuses or doesn't want to say, give any parameters about what it looks like. And usually that's because to do so would do some kind of damage to the individual, like let's say on a forensic case where you're doing child custody or something like that. Somebody's trying to use the disorder against them, that kind of thing.
Ah, okay. That does make sense. And yes, you are right. We've covered several different pathologies that all seem to have this other category, and that does make sense. That's usually for something that only meets like 50-75% of the typical criteria they want. It's not enough, but there's definitely something going on.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, they'll say, you know, needs 5 out of 7, and they'll have 3 out of 7 or 4 out of 7. Well, it's close enough for horseshoes, but not for the DSM. So they get the other specified, and usually what the clinician will do is say, you know, ADHD, other specified presentation with hyperactive and so features. So the person goes, oh, it kind of looks like this form of ADHD, or, you know, anxiety disorder, other specified that looks very obsessive, with obsessive compulsive features. So they go, oh, okay, it's not full-blown OCD and it's not OCPD, and okay, got it. And so it kind of gives you the kind of ballpark of what's happening.
Got it. Okay, perfect. Okay, next let's talk about causes. Source for this is Psychology Today. The short and sweet comment. Why some people develop DID is not entirely understood, but they frequently report having experienced severe physical and sexual abuse during childhood. This is not the end-all, be-all of the diagnosis, but it is a trend. Next comment is sourced clevelandclinic.org. What causes dissociative identity disorder? A history of trauma is a key feature of dissociative identity disorder. About 90% of the cases of DID involve some history of abuse. The trauma often involves severe emotional, physical, and/or sexual abuse. It might also be linked to accidents, natural disasters, and war. I didn't write this in the notes, but I did notice when I was doing this part of the research, it smells an awful lot like PTSD in the making. And I'm sure there's a relationship that hasn't been fully explored yet either.
I can talk to that when we get to the point where you want me to talk about that.
Why don't we do that now, since I brought it up?
Okay. So what you generally see, excuse me, if someone has really, 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 really significant trauma and or has it early enough, they'll develop PTSD, and then if they will try to manage the symptoms with a variety of ways that don't usually work. If they're really, really, really young and they have the PTSD thing, what they will likely do is kind of become someone else in their head, because and then it's as if they're an observer looking at someone with their name, and they become this other alter looking at themselves getting, you know, abused or whatever, or, you know, feeling miserable about the trauma. Because it's easier to sit back and go, oh my gosh, that sucks so badly. Oh my God, that's so horrible. Oh gosh, Johnny must be really suffering. And it's the way for them to distance themselves from the pain. Right? The problem with that is what starts out as a coping tool, if they keep doing it, if the trauma keeps happening and they can't find another better way to get, you know, to manage the trauma, then what happens is, as an adult, an event will happen that looks like, walks like, talks like, smells like the trauma, and they go into the altar that they created to deal with the trauma as if it's they're re-experiencing it, which is very much a PTSD-esque thing. Usually if this happens later, like late childhood, early adolescence, or adulthood, what the person will usually do is develop a cluster B personality disorder after if the PTSD isn't, you know, if they can't work around the PTSD through drugs or whatever, they'll often develop a personality disorder, most commonly borderline. And then if that doesn't take care of it, at sort of the end point of this continuum, the borderline stuff isn't enough to contain it, and they develop DID.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's your
brain
connection.
Just blew up a little bit. Okay. So
that's your
called
connection.
It.
Yes, ma'am. They are connected.
Yeah. As somebody who has PTSD, I'm just looking at this going, God, this all smells super familiar. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a variety of factors involved, like social support, level of resiliency. You know, if that happens kind of early, like late childhood, early adolescence, are you kind of an early bloomer in terms of your cognitive stuff? So do you have enough abstract reasoning prefrontals to go, wait a minute, this isn't about me. This is about this crazy, you know, person who's doing these crazy things to me. And you can sort of kind of half-ass reason it away so that you don't go into DID mode or don't go into borderline personality disorder mode. But that, I mean, there's just a shoot ton of factors involved. That, you know, is there a proclivity for anxiety disorders in your family? You know, so you have four or five generations of people with depression or anxiety, which makes you much more likely to fall prey to some of this stuff. Or do you have cluster B personality disorders that run in your family, right? And that makes you much more likely. So there's all these mitigating factors. It's certainly not a simple, let's plug this into, you know, AX squared plus BX plus 1 equals 0 kind of thing. It's a much more complicated picture than that.
Yes, of course. And that's why we need professional testing with competent people to make sure that that happens.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so Cleveland Clinic continues to say an important early loss, such as the loss of a parent or prolonged periods of isolation due to illness, may also be a factor in developing DID. Dissociation is often thought of as a coping mechanism that a person uses to disconnect from a stressful or traumatic situation or to separate traumatic memories from normal awareness. It's a way for a person to break the connection with the outside world and create distance from an awareness of what is occurring. Dissociation can serve as a defense mechanism against the physical or emotional pain of a traumatic or stressful experience. By dissociating painful memories from everyday thought processes, a person can use dissociation to maintain a relatively healthy level of functioning as though the trauma had not occurred. Episodes of DID can be triggered by a variety of real and symbolic traumas, including mild events such as being involved in a traffic accident, adult illness, or stress, or as a reminder of childhood abuse for a parent, maybe when the child reaches the same age at which the parent was abused. We'll talk about treatments for this in Section 4 later on. I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything else that you want to add.
No, we're good.
Okay, then let's go on down to Section 3, which is myths and misconceptions about dissociative identity disorder. So I have brought back some material from when we did Pathology Chic to remind you guys. So the episodes, Pathology Chic was about portrayals of certain mental health disorders in the media, in entertainment, in the news, you know, societal tropes and that sort of thing, stereotypes and poetic license and all that kind of bit. So this is what we had to say back then about it. Yeah. Famous Hollywood portrayals of DID, and this is a list, whether or not it is accurate. These are ones that are stipulated to be DID. So the list starts with Sybil, 1973, as true story, but portrayal was somewhat inaccurate. Three Faces of Eve, 1957, true story of Chris Costner Sizemore, accurate but very dated. Trina Gavin, the character Jade, in the movie Jade, 2003, grossly inaccurate. Kevin and 22 more personalities, which I won't list here, in the movie Split, 2016, considered inaccurate. Tyler Durden, or the narrator, in Fight Club, 1996, movie and a book. It is somewhat fuzzy and unclear how accurate this is considered to be. It's a matter of opinion. Norman Bates in Psycho, 1960, very inaccurate. And Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, 1931, and several iterations since, inaccurate.
Yeah, I want to comment.
Yeah, go ahead.
The main thing that makes Kevin and Split, or one of the things that really makes that not accurate, is most of the different alters are not violent. They're not physically dangerous for the most part.
I haven't actually seen the movie. Is Kevin himself dangerous?
Oh, yeah. It's really
like,
well done.
You know, I saw the trailer and I wasn't
really
sure
well
who was doing things. So, you know, I didn't know if that was him doing stuff or his altars or what. You know, I didn't really know.
Yeah.
Okay.
So part of the movie is very accurate, but some of it is just totally done for, you know, dramatic value. Most altars are not physically dangerous. They're not. That's the person with DID is more of a danger to himself or herself than that person is to anybody else.
Okay, so these portrayals of, like, you know, my secret personality is going to come kill you, that's all dramatic license and has no basis in reality.
Okay. Yeah, Norman Bates is much more a schizophrenic than he is anything else. And, you know, he's been traumatized and schizophrenic, but he's not DID. Yeah.
Yeah. That seems to be one of the most common misconceptions that people who don't know very much about either one very typically think that cases of DID are schizophrenia, and occasionally the other way around, I have noticed.
Mm-hmm. That's
okay.
Very true.
So the next list I have is non-fictional cultural and societal stereotypes and assumptions about these pathologies. Not all of these are inaccurate. Some of them may have a bit of merit. So these are some of the stereotypes. DID and schizophrenia are the same thing. Not accurate, but super common.
Mm-hmm.
DID is lots of separate people in one body. Mostly inaccurate, kind of a bad way of explaining it, mostly.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
DID, formerly multiple personality disorder, MPD, or split personalities. These are all the same pathology. They had different names as our understanding of it improved and got tightened up medically. People with DID are just faking it. Complete BS.
Yeah, unless people you're a forensic person trying to get out of it through pretending to be.
Yeah. Actually, out of curiosity, just to have a little bit of a basic instinct moment, I know that we're dealing with different pathology, but, you know, on the question of people pretending, to, you know, knowing, reading things, knowing what something is like and pretending to fake it, how hard would it be to fake it to the point of being mistaken for authentic without extreme scrutiny?
Depends on how good the person is, depends on how smart they are, depending on how, you know, how knowledgeable they are of the pathology to reproduce it. I would think DID is going to be pretty hard to fake unrealistic kind of a, people do the same thing with schizophrenia to get out of, you know, committing horrible crimes. And usually if you do a good enough interview and give the appropriate testing, you can pretty much blow that stuff out of the water. But occasionally you get people who are, like, really smart and, unfortunately, really pathologically antisocial as well who get away with that stuff. But fortunately, not a lot of them.
Gotcha. Okay. So some more stereotypes. People with DID live highly abnormal lives. And that can be true. There's lots of them that are doing pretty typically.
Mm-hmm. Again, it depends on the degree, too, and how many alters they have and how are they managing it. And, I mean, it's just all kind of factors go in.
Gotcha. Another one is people with multiple personalities don't know about the other personalities. So, awful lot of this is Hollywood portrayal. How accurate is that in real life? Like, is it typical for them to know about the alters? Okay, so it can be either one. Not like a majority of one way or the other. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
All right. Switching between personality states is obvious. I believe that is sometimes yes, but a lot of times not necessarily.
That's
is
true.
That true?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
And you can never recover from DID. Is that true?
No, but it's very difficult, and it requires a long time and a lot of work, and most people can't manage it very well. You don't ever – I don't know of anybody that's quote-unquote cured, but it's certainly manageable. But to be manageable, quote-unquote recover from, really, 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 really requires long-term work, almost lifelong work, and a lot of support, and not a lot of people have those sorts of resources.
Got it. Okay. So last comment on that. Movies such as Split can be extremely damaging, argues Dr. Simone Reinders, a neuroscientist studying DID at King's College London, in collaboration with universities in the Netherlands. Quote, they make it seem as if patients with DID are extremely violent and prone to doing bad things. This is actually not true. Oh, here you go. This is stuff you said earlier. This is actually not true, and it very badly misrepresents the psychiatric disorder. Individuals with DID definitely do not have a tendency to be violent, more a tendency to hide their mental health problems. I'm very concerned about the effects that movie will have for patients with DID and how the general public will now see those patients. There's already a lot of stigma and skepticism concerning this specific disorder. End quote. And here I will pause. Yeah.
The same applies for schizophrenia, too, because a lot of schizophrenics are portrayed in the movie as very dangerous and murderous, and that's not true either. I mean, there's a very, very small population of them that are, but they are because they think that there's danger. They're you know, hallucinating or deluding, and they think that, you know, there's some dangerous thing, and they're out to destroy the danger. And, of course, there is none because it's all in their head, but that's a very, very, very small number of folks. Most of them, like the DID folks, are very embarrassed. If they know about their stuff, they're very embarrassed. They're very isolatory. They're not mean. They're not evil, wicked, mean, and nasty, to quote John K.F. Steppenwolf.
Fair. Okay, so that is the end for this section. Is there anything else about this part that we want to cover before we move on?
Nope, we're good. Thanks.
All righty. So the last thing I want to talk about is suggestions for coping and mitigating symptoms. First comment is sourced from Psychology Today Online, and they said, the primary treatment for DID is long-term psychotherapy with the goal of deconstructing the different personalities and integrating them into one. Other treatments include cognitive and creative therapies. Excuse me. Although there are no medications that specifically treat this disorder, antidepressants, anti-anxiety drugs, or tranquilizers might be prescribed to help control the psychological symptoms associated with it. With proper treatment, many people who are impaired by DID experience improvement in their ability to function in their work and personal lives. Next question. Can DID be healed? Current consensus is that DID cannot technically be cured or eliminated. However, there is a subjective but promising success rate with some therapies to mitigate the symptoms and behaviors to sufficient enough levels to allow a patient to conduct a generally, quote, normal basic life, hold down a job, get an education, and many other common life goals.
Definitely.
Next comment, clevelandclinic.org, how is dissociative identity disorder treated? And they said, the goals of treatment for DID are to relieve symptoms, ensure the safety of the individual and those around him or her, and, quote, reconnect the different personalities into one integrated, well-functioning identity. Treatment also aims to help the person safely express and process painful memories, develop new coping skills and life skills, restore optimal functioning, and improve relationships. The best treatment approach depends on the individual, the nature of any identifiable triggers, and the severity of the symptoms. Most likely treatment will include some combination of the following methods. Clinical hypnosis, a treatment method that uses intense relaxation, concentration, and focused attention to achieve an altered state of consciousness, allowing people to explore thoughts, feelings, and memories they may have hidden from their conscious minds.
Yeah, think of clinical hypnosis. Think of clinical hypnosis as controlled DID, because it's you putting yourself in a purposeful altered state in order to achieve some goal, whether it's relaxation, focusing, better performance musically or athletically, or calming down, or whatever. So it's controlled association.
Interesting. Do you think that's fairly similar to like meditation techniques?
It is absolutely similar. It's the same thing. It's very, and the mindfulness stuff, the same thing.
Yeah. Okay.
And the PMR, progressive muscle relaxation, same uses some of the same elements.
Got it. Okay. Fair enough. Okay.
Yeah.
So the next one, cognitive behavioral therapy or CBT. This form of psychotherapy focuses on changing dysfunctional thinking patterns, feelings, and behaviors. Next is creative therapies, for example, art therapy, music therapy, etc. These therapies allow patients to explore and express their thoughts, feelings, and experiences in a safe and creative environment. Next, dialectic behavior therapy, or DBT. I think, was that what you were talking about earlier? Did you mention that? Okay.
Yeah. DBT really a subset of cognitive behavioral therapy with the mindfulness component thrown in.
Got it. Okay. So they describe it as a form of psychotherapy for people with severe personality disturbances, which can include dissociative symptoms that often occur after an experience of abuse or trauma. Next is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, or EDMR. EMDR. Yeah. This technique was designed to treat people with persistent nightmares, flashbacks, and other symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And, gosh, they seem to be related.
imagine that.
Yeah. Next is family therapy. This helps teach the family about the disorder as well as helping family members recognize symptoms of a recurrence. Medication. There is no medication to treat dissociative disorders themselves. However, people with dissociative disorders, especially those with associated depression and or anxiety, may benefit from treatment with antidepressant or anti-anxiety medications. Meditation and relaxation techniques. Just got done talking about that.
Yep.
These help people to better tolerate their dissociative symptoms and become more aware of their internal states. And last, psychotherapy, sometimes called, quote, talk therapy. Psychotherapy is the main treatment for dissociative disorders. This is a broad term that includes several forms of therapy.
Yeah, all
and
of these are actually different forms of, quote, unquote, minus medication. All of these are actually various forms of, quote, unquote, psychotherapy.
Got it. So outlook or prognosis. People with DID generally respond well to treatment. However, and Dr. Mathis mentioned this earlier, treatment can be a long and painstaking process. This usually begins by identifying and empowering all personalities to help integrate them into a full functioning whole. To improve a person's outlook, it is important to treat any other problems or complications, such as depression, anxiety, or substance abuse. And here we are at the end of that. So I'm going to check in with you and see if you would like to add anything else.
Yeah, the other thing you have to be careful and look out for with folks with DID is they're at pretty high self-injurious and suicide risk in addition to substance abuse because they're trying to medicate stuff away. So you always have to be kind of on guard with that. I also frequently advise against the use of anxiolytics, anti-anxiety medications, because all of them are potentially addicting. And so if you have somebody who has a substance abuse problem on top of that, anxiolytics are probably the last drugs you ever want to give them, minus opioids. So not a real good idea.
Got it. So interesting. Why do you think it is that there's such a high instance of suicide ideation behavior with this pathology? What is that for people who have it?
They get sick of it. It's the same thing with bipolar. They get sick of doing it. They're like, I'm not doing this the rest of my life. Let's get this shit on the road and get over with. I don't want to deal with it. I mean, you can hardly blame them.
Despair and being overloaded, essentially.
Yeah, it's an escape avoidance tool, just like substance abuse is. And you can understand if somebody's doing this and they have many alters that are causing all kinds of problems in their life, and you know, they end up homeless, or they end up losing their jobs, or they end up losing relationships or marriages, or get kicked out of college or whatever. It's got to be hugely negatively impacting your self-esteem, self-value. It's just, you get tired of the stuff. And the bipolar is the same way. They get tired of the ups and downs, and it's just, it gets very, very tiring. And that's why you see a very high suicide rate with that group also.
Got it. Okay. So, in summary, we hope now that our listeners better understand dissociative identity disorder. It's not one of the more common pathologies that many of our listeners may have dealt with, yet it is much more common than many people realize. Hopefully, we've disabused our listeners of stereotypes and misinformation on DID so that they can be better prepared should they find themselves needing to address this condition for themselves or a loved one. So this concludes our show on dissociative identity disorder. And Dr. Mathis, is there anything else that you would like to add in closing?
Nope, I'm good. Thanks for asking.
Okay. So on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening. We're wrapping a little bit early, but that's okay. We want to give our appreciation to those of you who might be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. And we will see you guys in 2 weeks with a new topic for discussion on Wednesday, September 16th, 11 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on blogtalkradio.com. We'd also like to give a shout-out to other NDB Media shows coming up in the next couple of weeks. Travel Itch Radio follows us Thursday, tomorrow, the 3rd of September, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. He conquered Everest, ran Death Valley, and earned the nickname the Endurance King. Now, Marshall Ulrich, the ultimate adventure traveler, is coming to Travel Hitch Radio to promote his newest book, Both Feet on the Ground, Reflections from the Outside. Dan Schlossberg and co-host Mary Ellen Nugent-Lee learn about an Ulrich travelogue that has spanned more than 60 countries, including Borneo, Tibet, Morocco, and South Africa. Sports Talk with the Guys, Saturday Morning Extravaganza, Saturday, September 5th, 9 a.m. Eastern Time. The Monday Morning Quarterbacks are live on Saturday morning. No one is safe while they troll the digital airwaves. Please join them as they discuss the latest news in the world of sports and review the events of the past week. Next, and this has a few changes I'd like to note for you guys, the Walking Dead online viewing party. Okay, a little bit more data. Season 10, Episode 16, A Certain Doom, will air on the 4th of October, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. On the Comic-Con at Home panel, Angela Kang, who's a showrunner, announced that Season 11 will not be able to begin airing in 2020 due to COVID-19 delays. Instead, as I mentioned to you guys earlier, there will be 6 more episodes that will be tacked on to the end of Season 10 that will air in early 2021. And you'll have to listen real closely how the timing is going to work on this, because it's the usual patterns that we're used to, but there's a third show involved. So the new third Walking Dead series, World Beyond, will also premiere Season 1, Episode 1, Brave, on October 4th at 10 p.m., immediately following The Walking Dead pseudo-finale. Fear the Walking Dead Season 6, Episode 1, The End is the Beginning, will air the following weekend, October 11th at 9 p.m., and run 8 episodes until 11:29. More details as we get closer. So essentially what's going to happen is The Walking Dead ostensible finale will be October 4th, and right when that is over at 10 p.m., the third series will premiere, and that'll run at 10 p.m., and it'll continue, but Fear is going to be on at 9 o'clock the rest of the season. And then, probably in February, which is when they typically pick back up, we're going to have these mystery 6 extra episodes that are still Season 10. And it's what they've cobbled together from what they could manage to do and still observe COVID restrictions with the staff and edit everything together. So that's what's going on. A little sticky. I'll be going over this again next time for you. Next, Jedi Tax Radio, Sunday the 6th. A new show airing monthly on First Sundays. Rogelio de Noriega, CRTP, with 33 years of income tax preparation experience discussing the latest news in income taxes, ongoing issues for taxpayers and tax preparers. If you have a question you need answered, contact him at Twitter, the IRS man. Special guests and co-hosts will join him. See also www.jedi.tax. Monday Night in America with Roger Noriega. That I have it as the 6th, but that should be the 7th. Pardon me. So the 7th, Monday, 10 p.m., Roger Noriega brings you his unique take on politics, current events, entertainment, sci-fi, and history. And last but certainly not least, Fandom Access, The Week in Review, Tuesday the 7th. Ugh, my dates are all messed up. I apologize to you guys. Anyway, join the chatty critics, Jamie, Karen, and AJ, Tuesday night, whatever the stupid date is. I'll look it up later. I'm really tired. As they digest another night of TV. Thank you guys for joining us. Please look for us on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody. We will see you next time, and rock on.